Well, we've been discussing kind of the rise of how public education got started in America way back in the 1700s and 1800s, and we were talking about then some of the prominent people that we're going to discuss that were involved in that time. And we left off last time discussing what was going on in Massachusetts. Nothing against New England, Ben, just a little bit. But it's not New Hampshire, so it's still kind of God's country up there, according to Ben. But New England and Massachusetts is really where things began to get started. That was really where a lot of early things happened in our country. Of course, that's where things were colonized and things of that nature. But we discussed here, it was the first government-financed and state-controlled education system. Before then, it was up to the parents, the families in a local district. They would get together. They would find a teacher. They would take care of the education. And then we begin to see the state kind of grabbing a few things and taking over some things here and there. And then we have the governor, Edward Everett. We're going to talk about him a little bit. Representative in the state there, James Carter, and some of the influences that they did. And we're going to look at some of the philosophies behind what they did, really from the old Prussian area. We're going to discuss that because that was very influential into what the mindset of the public school system, the education system as a whole, began to come out. Massachusetts Act of 1837 was kind of where we left off because Everett was the one that pushed this in Massachusetts. Carter was actually the one that wrote the bill, wrote the legislation, and we're going to look at some of their influences a little bit later. Here is what that bill did. Let's collect information. It was a survey is what it started out as, to collect information on the common schools, those schools that the families were involved with, those schools that the parents were doing. Well, the government wanted to know, are they really doing a good job? Now, remember, we discussed last week how the system of education had worked and how the literacy rate was very, very high, how these young people were, you know, entering Harvard at age 13 and 15 and things like that and were well-versed in Latin and Greek. I mean, you know, when I was that old, I don't know what I was doing, but it wasn't Latin and Greek, I can tell you that. And when I got to Greek 1 in college, I said, shoo, maybe I should have started when I was 5. I don't know. But they were very smart. It was working was the point. It was working. And the government gets involved and somehow they think they can make things better by pumping more money into it or whatever that mindset is. And so the government says, well, we don't know that these families can do it good enough. Are they really going to be loyal to the state? We're going to discuss where that came from. And so they think they have to get in and get control of it. So let's survey these schools so we can find out how bad of a job they're doing. And then we can report to the people and to the journals and to the government what they need to do to fix the problem. So they believed that they should maybe have a state board of education that would control the policies and the laws and the rules for these schools and make sure they're doing it the way the state wants it to be done. And this was really the beginning of the first state board of education. So we're seeing a shift from it being with the homes and the families running it and being in charge of it versus now it's going toward the state. And eventually, 1979, we have the federal bureaucracy of the Department of Education from a federal standpoint. So they wanted to also study and analyze teacher education. What do these teachers really know? Are the teachers maybe having an old traditional philosophy of the Bible and stuff? Well, that's not going to help them become good citizens of the state. And so we've got to control the education of the teachers so that they're really indoctrinating the kids with what this State Board of Education wants them to be taught. And then Horace Mann, as we're going to talk about, became the first secretary of the board. I mean, these men, Carter and Everett, were very liberal for their time. Carter believed that education would control your mind. That's what the purpose of education is, to control the kids' minds. We're going to look at some of the people that influenced them and some of these things here today because we think, well, these guys just wrote it, no big deal. I'm going to tell you, it's interesting, and Pastor and I see this a lot when we go to the state meetings here in Tallahassee. We go once a year for the Department of Children and Families, and it's all about the rule writing and the legislation that they write. It's interesting that the state board of the House of Representatives and the Senate and on the governor, they write these bills and they pass them, and then they give the rulemaking authority to the department. And they have a wide purview to be able to write whatever they want into those rules. And so it's not that really coming from the representatives in the Senate and the bill that they pass. It's these little bureaucrats sitting in these offices that are really writing these things and coming up with crazy things and things that you have to follow. I was telling Tara some of them. I mean, if you're a fully licensed daycare, you can't even have a water activity without a 1-to-1 ratio. Okay, so we've got a 6-inch kiddie pool, so you have to have one adult per kid. Now, what daycare center can afford to have 50 parents for 50 kids or 50 workers? I mean, it's just insane. But they get in there and they write all these kids, these people that write this stuff have no idea about education. They have no idea about families. They have, we're the Department of Children and Families, but they don't have a biblical perspective of the children and families. It's a liberal mindset from what they learned in college in some social justice, social study type class, and they're majored in this stuff. And then they're going to be the ones, these little kids, really, right out of college, that are sitting in an office writing the rules for this stuff. That's where it comes from. And so here we've got, this state is controlling this. And it's very influential. You think, well, these guys, you know, who, you know, this is no big deal. They were trying their hardest. Well, let's look at what they actually believed. We're going to look at what Horace Mann believed. We're going to look at the influences from Pestalozzi, McClure, and Prussia. And it's eye-opening. Now, this is way back in the 1800s. It's eye-opening to see what they wanted and how they eventually got there. So let's look at Horace Mann. He's called the father of public education. He was the first secretary of the board, the State Board of Education of the state of Massachusetts, which was the first one established. Let's look at Horace Mann and talk about a few things with him. Just going to go quickly with his early life. He was born in Massachusetts, 1796. Now, here's an important point that I want to bring up here. His father died when he was just 13 years old, and his brother died in the same area, maybe the next year. There's a little bit of controversy of when that exactly was, but 12, 13 years old, 14, that area. His brother died. Now, his brother, he was in a congregational, hyper-Calvinist, very hard church where, you know, we discussed some of that in our Calvinistic study. But that congregational pastor, the boy had gone swimming and he had drowned. And that's how he died, Horace Mann's brother. Now, the boy had gone swimming in a local whatever pond or whatever kind of thing. And he did that on a Sunday. And so the pastor preached very harshly that it was God's judgment on the boy for swimming on Sunday, and that's why he drowned. And what do you think that did to Horace Mann? That he got very upset at that. And he realized, well, if that's the kind of God that we have, then I don't want anything to do with him. And so he rejected that congregational type mindset, and he became a Unitarian, which denies the deity of Christ, the deity of God. You know, I mean, you can get into the debate. I'm not going to get into debate about swimming on Sunday. We're not going to debate that. But I'm telling you, there's a right and wrong way to approach things. You imagine if your kid just died, well, God judged you because he swam on Sunday. What? That may not be the wisest approach to that. Again, we're not going to get into those arguments, but it turned him off of God. And he became a Unitarian, that God exists, but he's very, very transcendent up there, and he doesn't involve himself here. Because in his mind, what kind of God would judge a 12-year-old boy for jumping in a swimming hole on a Sunday? So he shut him out. And he became a Unitarian at a very, very young age. God's not personal. And then that led him to a variety of other beliefs that were wrong. Denied depravity. Denied that, you know, we're actually sinful. Denied it all. And one thing about him was there was a local library in his city, his town there in Franklin. And he read all the books in that library. There were over 100 volumes there, and even as a boy, he read. And he was reading even things, philosophies from Europe and all those kind of things that were coming over. And he was, I mean, you imagine a 12-year-old boy reading deep things like that. And it really influenced him at an early age. Now, he was tutored by a teacher at that time. I find it kind of funny. He didn't go through a public school to get into Brown University at 1816. He did it the way that was being established, where the family chose, and he was tutored by this teacher, and he got into Brown, and he began to study law, and eventually is going to become a lawyer. He also tried some teaching. But here, that's kind of his early life, and you can see how he denied the personal nature of God at a very early age and began to deny depravity and things of that nature. Now, after college, a few quick things here, he became a lawyer. He also taught Latin and Greek and was a librarian, and he was noted in history that he was not a very good teacher. His students actually hated him. Because he gave impossible assignments. That was the thing. You know, maybe you've had a teacher like that you've thought gave the most impossible assignment ever, and I'm going to go string him up. What's his problem? So I just tell Eva, just wait till you get to my class. I'm going to talk about impossible assignments. I'm just kidding. That's Mr. Center. He gives impossible assignments. He learned that from his wife. Just kidding. No, we try not to give him impossible assignments, just semi-impossible. No. But I mean, his students just hated his guts. He was a terrible teacher. And I always find it's so interesting. These guys that are terrible at education become the ones that influence it. It's like, you're really bad at your... Well, they say that. I'm slamming teachers here. I don't mean to. But it's like, those who can't teach, that's what they say. You're a terrible engineer. Go teach in college. You know, or something like that. I don't know. They joke about that. Maybe it's a bad joke. I don't know. But some people teach because they love to teach. But Ryan, remember, you fail at your engineering, you're a terrible engineer, just go teach somewhere. All right, there's always an out for you. That's why Ryan's an excellent engineer, actually. But anyway, it's interesting. I mean, these guys, he was a terrible teacher. But yet he is the authority on how we're going to do public education in America for the rest of time. I just always find that interesting. He was appointed to the State House of Representatives in 1827. And then he entered the Massachusetts Senate in 1833. He was the Senate president for 2 years. So he's rising in influence and prominence there in Massachusetts. And he's going to really begin to get involved with this Massachusetts Act of 1837. Again, the governor was pushing for it. Carter wrote it. Horace Mann then tries to become very involved with it. He's the president of the Senate. He's going to help push it through, those kind of things. And this is the first legislation ever of public education. This is it right here. And they chose, again, what was that act doing? Did a survey, and it established a state board of education. So you have to have a secretary of that state board. And who did they choose? They chose Horace Mann. Actually, Horace Mann took, quote, a pay cut to become the secretary of the board because he believed it was such an influential thing. There's written in history some of the things from his journal and things like that. So the governor appointed a voluntary committee to search for the secretary of the new board. And so they began to talk to Mann and try to encourage him to do it. He wrote in his journal in 1837, in May, he said, "Whoever becomes the secretary must encounter privation, labor, and annoyance from schemers, and is going to have to go through toil to arrive at a true system." He knew it was going to be hard. He knew that the families were not going to like this. Do you think? And he knew that he had to just push through, ignore what the family says, to do what the government wants. That was it. We see that a lot today. You know, you think, well, you're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. Man, I've been in the meetings. I've heard what these people say. Well, you got to let the government start taking over the education of a child at 2 years old because the families don't do a good job. They write that stuff. They say that stuff. They don't like you as a parent being in control of what your children learn. They hate that. Started way back in 1837. These families, it's going to be hard. Nobody's going to like it, but whoever is the secretary must persevere. He also wrote things about the statist philosophy. He said it's the first great movement to organize a system of education. And he said those who don't have a secretary of state would be vulnerable. Those who don't do what Massachusetts is going to do are going to fail. You know, that's interesting too. When people try to push an agenda or when they try to push a narrative, they always play the worst case scenario of if you don't. You hear that today? A lot, don't you? You disagree with the narrative, boy, you're going to end up like this. You're going to jump, and on and on and on and on they go. And they jump to the worst case scenario in everything. They don't like you to have the ability to think. So he was like, well, you know, this is a big deal. Those who reject this state board of education, oh, they're going to be vulnerable. They're going to fail. They're going to all die. Oh, Chris, it's a two-hander. We joke about that. You know, this panic, they push the red button. We're all going to die. I want my mommy. You know, that's the way they do things. And they make you fear. So these other states, we're going to tell them things that make them so afraid that if they don't get a state board of education, they're going to fail. All the kids are going to end up in prison. That's what they said. We're going to get to that in a minute. So we intimidate with fear for them to follow what the narrative they're trying to push. They've been doing it forever. That's the way Satan works, and he's going to continue to work that way. So then in June of 1837, he said, "I have received the offer. The path of usefulness is before me. I have the opportunity to be used. My present purpose is to enter it, and then God grant me wisdom. Okay, great. God grant me an annihilation of selfishness, a mind of wisdom, a heart of benevolence, and a spirit of self-abandonment and martyrdom is needed. I'm sacrificing everything. Look what all I gave up to just do this state board and to try to push this through, and everybody's attacking me for doing this. Playing the martyr. We see that still today as well. Just play it up. So he gave up his career, president of the Senate, and all those he could have probably gone on to other things. He gave all that up so that he could take this low-paying job. I find this interesting as well. The first thing he did. Now, here is the first ever secretary of a state board of education. You know the first thing he had to do? Take a crash course in education. Didn't know anything about education, was a horrible teacher, was a lawyer. In other words, I'm not attacking lawyers. It's just he didn't major in education. He didn't know anything about it. He was a lawyer. He tried to teach law and Latin and Greek and stuff, and he was terrible. So he knows nothing about education. What does that tell you? Did he really care about the education of kids? No. He cared about government control. Bottom line, that's all he cared about. The state taking over. So he went to the American Journal of Education, the Journal of American Education, which was started from the Lyceum we talked about a couple weeks ago, that education adult where they would share articles and share ideas. And William McClure was one of the main authors, and that was a Pestalozzian. You may have never heard of that word before. That's a man from Verdun, Switzerland, I think. And his educational philosophy was crazy. And that's who these people were reading. That was the model they were going for. I'm going to talk about him in a little bit if we have, hopefully we'll have time. So, well, let's just talk about it now. He was Pestalozzian. So here's what, he started this school in Switzerland in Verdun. And so he founded this school in the early 1800s, and he supported Rousseau, that the child is actually inherently good. You just have to keep your hands off and let him blossom. And let him just grow into what he wants to be. You hear that a lot today, don't you? You know. Oh, we don't know, a boy or a girl, we don't know. Let them choose. Oh, is that the way it works? Or, well, we don't, just let them on their own decide. Just hands off. They'll come to it on their own. I've said it many times. If I had hands-off teachers and if I was in school with Mr. Whitney, the last thing on our mind would have been learning something. You hands off and it would have been throwing crayons, shooting spitballs, pulling the ponytails of the girls, which I never did to my sisters, and all that kind of stuff. You know, we would have been a handful. Yeah, hands off, and I would not have learned a thing. Yeah, because every boy wants to sit down and read. No. By the way, I love boys being all boy. Don't get me wrong. I love that. So I love seeing boys running and energy, and I love it. It's awesome. I digress. We've got to move on. Anyway, here's the axioms in his school. He argued that evil comes from a bad environment. Okay, so evil isn't in you. It's just when you're in a bad environment, that environment causes you to be evil. And that's what brings out the bad in you. So somehow if we can make a natural Edenic environment, why do these guys always push for these utopias? Like Robert Owen that started the New Harmony in Indiana that fell flat on its face, or all these other utopias you could read about in history. Because the problem with man is not sin. The problem is his environment. They don't want to talk about the sin issue. They want to talk about, well, we can fix it on our own. Because if you admit that there's sin, you have to admit that you need God to fix the problem. We ignore that. We say it's something man-made so that man can fix the problem and that man can control it. Exactly the way they think about these things. So we need a man-made environment that is free from any type of restrictions that man could bring, like a teacher with rules. Oh, that's terrible. It's so restrictive, and it's going to actually bring out the evil. Okay, the child is running around the classroom, and the only reason that's wrong is because the teacher said it was against one of the rules. See, if the rule didn't exist, then he wouldn't be wrong. Wrong is wrong despite what rules exist in man's mind. If I disobey my teacher or disobey my parents or am disrespectful to my parents, even if they have a rule, they didn't have a rule that said it doesn't matter, it's still wrong. Well, there was no rule that said I couldn't walk up and punch my sister in the face. It's still wrong. Just because man didn't have a list of rules. So that's the way they do this. We're going to make this environment with no restrictions, because restrictions just cause the child to be more evil. You take the restrictions out, you're going to see some evil. Just going to lay that out to you. Because it's in man's heart to do evil. And you can take away every restriction and that evil is going to flow more. The only way to fix the evil is to teach them about Christ and the gospel that will transform their lives. That'll take care of evil. Again, we want to ignore the God situation. Then he argued that education, here's where they get this. If you want to change society, you have to have education. Social reform has got to come. And he said, and this is Pestalozzi, that if you can reach the really young ones, then you can change society. And the older, they may be already too far gone, but we got to work on these young ones. Now, we've watched in our country compulsory education get younger and younger. Okay, now it's K-5 and above, mandatory. Under President Obama, they didn't push it. They tried to push it through. But under his last 2 or 3 years, there was a majority of opposition in the House and Senate that never passed the bill through. He wanted these education bills that required it at 4 years old, and then in a transition over time to 3, 2, and their mantra was from cradle to grave. I heard him say it. I've been to Washington. I've seen the bills. You're too dumb as a parent. You don't know what you're doing. But let the government come in and take your child from birth, and we'll take care of them all the way to the end. In other words, we don't want them anymore. We'll euthanize them. It's the way they think. Social evolution. We can take care of all this. Now, you know, you start your children in school when you decide to start them. Why? Because that's the Bible way. You're in charge of that education as a parent. If you're comfortable with your child starting in K-4, Miss Adams would love to have them, and she'll teach them how to read by Christmas, hopefully. If my boys can do it, anybody can. And she'll teach them, and they'll have a good time. Or if you feel like, you know what, I don't believe the Lord wants me to start them until 5. Great, start them at 5. Well, you know what, I think I'm going to homeschool them until they're in second grade. Great! You are accountable as a parent to God for the education of your children. And the government hates that statement. They want to be in charge. They want to control everything. So in this school, Pestalozzi, that wanted social reform, evil comes from your bad environment. So there was, you know, no understanding. You know, he said that you have to understand before you believe. Versus the Bible way we talked about last week, fear the Lord's beginning of knowledge. You've got to believe if you want to understand anything. There is no education without understanding the fear of the Lord first. You want true education? Go to the cross. Let the gospel change your darkened mind, and you're going to open up a world of education you never imagined. It starts with Christ. But they don't like that. You got to understand before you believe anything. Oh, you know, there's no evidence that God exists, and we don't believe in that. We've understood some stuff. That was his mindset. So they downplayed things like memorization. Don't need to memorize anything. Don't read. Don't need to learn to read. You shouldn't have any type of discipline in the classroom. That was Pestalozzi. That was way back in the 1800s in Switzerland. And somehow they grabbed it and thought it was the greatest thing in the world, and they dumped it in Massachusetts in the 1800s, today people, you made those kids memorize something. How dare you? I'm going to tell you right now, Ms. Pepperd and I both can attest to this. We see the problems when kids in elementary school are not taught to memorize. You can't critically think and reason through something when you're older if you can't memorize a basis foundation of truth and knowledge when you're young. We get kids that transfer into middle school that can't add, people. Add. Been in public school their whole life. They don't know what a fourth plus a fourth is. They look at that and say, what's that? because we don't force them or teach them, I shouldn't say force, we don't teach them to memorize. Your teachers are drilling and killing. Killing them kids. Drill, drill, drill. I'm going to tell you something right now. I've said it before, and I'm not trying to be braggadocious or anything. I'm just stating facts. I was in a school that was traditional, kind of like ours, where we learned in elementary all of the multiplication tables, 1 through 12, memorized them all. I did not use a calculator. We were not allowed to until after Algebra 2. We did everything on paper. I could multiply, drop a hat. Had to learn it. Logarithms with a table. Not calculator. Log of 42. Good. If you don't know what a logarithm is, Mr. Pegg will show you. It's just an exponent. Slide rollers, yeah. We had tables. We were flipping through. What's the logarithm of 45? Oh, what is it in base E? We were using books with tables on it. Now we just can't. I'm not against a calculator. I tell the kids, great, save your time. I want you to learn the concept. Once you know the basics, use it to save time. No problem. But I'm telling you, we don't teach this, the facts anymore. Oh, we don't need phonics. You know what? With phonics, you can learn how to read anything. You can dissect that word down. Miss Center teaches roots. The high schoolers were like, Seth was like, we're learning roots. Oh, I said, poor baby. She teaches them Greek and Latin words as their vocabulary in high school this year. Why? Because they can probably get pretty close to figuring out what that word is, at least close, if they know the roots. Right? Oh, you meanie. You're making them memorize something. That's so that they can think. Our world is all about, let them have 21st century thinking skills and critical problem-solving skills. But we give them nothing as a basis with which to use to solve the problems. Go to Mrs. Fretwell's class in third grade. You're going to hear the class tearing through it. 3 times 3 is 9. 3 times 4 is 12. 3 times 5 is 18. Sorry, Ryan. Were you listening? 3 times 6 is 18. They burn through it, and they have this little contest that if by the end of the year or by the end of a certain time, if they can say a certain number of them under a minute, Mrs. Pat Smith used to do this. She'd bring them brownies. Oh, man, they were like, we're getting them brownies home. I'm going to tell you right now, we're going to drill through them. And, the poor kids like Chris Whitney were probably in the back just mouthing. Yep, we're going to get to brownies. We're going to get there. 4 times 4. How are you, Maria? Yep, my friend, speak louder. So, it's the way the world works. But this is back in the mid-1800s. Don't memorize. You're being mean to the kids. I'm glad somebody made me memorize. And I'll tell you, when I was a kid, you know what drove it home to me? I've talked about this before, and I was in the 80s. Way back, I tell the high schooler, like, the 80s, and some of y'all are like, 80s? never mind. I love you, Caroline. No, Mr. Baker's like, 80s, man. That was regular living for me. Anyway, I was like, way back in the dark ages in the 80s, our Christian school prayed for missionary or people, Christians in Russia. It was still in that communistic time. And they were out meeting in the woods and stuff like that. And it drove it home to me that they didn't have a Bible. And they craved being able to just memorize one verse. By word have I hid in my heart. You can hide it here. They could take the paper. They couldn't take the heart. And I thought, boy, memorizing is important. We got hundreds of Bibles over here. You know what? About 3 weeks ago, they were burning in the streets with the American flag? The Bible. Now, I'm not being conspiracy nut, but I'm telling you, people hate God's Word, and one day they might take it out of here. That's a hate book. You better be hiding it. That's why we teach our kids to memorize, not just so that they can think later, but they can memorize the Bible. It's the only hope they've got. If everything else falls apart, I'm going to be with my Lord one day. I've got His Word in my heart. That's what matters. These people hate that. They hate it. Don't force these kids. Let them on their own. I'm not going to memorize something as an 8-year-old if my teacher doesn't make me. I can tell you, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to be like, I'm going to go home and play war and guns and the stuff we did. Well, that's probably impolitically correct these days. And we did all kinds of fun stuff. But that's what I would be doing. I'd be staring out the window. My brother-in-law, Megan's brother, Megan has 3 triplet siblings. They're triplets, and they were all in my grade growing up. We were pretty close. And a Kevin, about a month ago, I went to visit and help my mother-in-law paint her new house. And Kevin was so excited to drive from Greensboro with his 2500 Duramax, pulling the trailer with his new tractor. He was just, I mean, that's the way he's been. He was just living high on the hog. He got my tractor out and he was bush hogging and all kinds of stuff. And Catherine, his sister, and I were laughing. And we said, do you remember in fourth grade in our old schoolhouse, we'd be sitting there and we're doing our work and Kevin staring out the window, looking at the tractor, just. And now his dreams have come to fruition. We were picking on him about it, and he was just laughing. So, you know, that's what I ought to be doing. I wouldn't be able to memorize them. I'm like, where's the tractor at? Where's the four-wheeler or whatever? We're going to go have some fun. I hate it. You know, don't think it's being mean. You got to force kids to do some stuff. It's not being mean. I want them to learn. I want them to understand how to use their hands. I want them to understand these things. So, yeah, let them alone. They'll do it on their own. No, they won't. They won't do it. I'm going to tell you right now, they won't. If you don't believe me, try it for a day. Stay in your room all day at home, and keep the door closed, and watch what happens. Yeah, yes. Just make sure you call, keep 911 with you. You know, and I'm not saying be mean to your kids. No, obviously I'm not doing that. Give them a cleaning list. Give them some things to do. Teach them how to do something. I'm glad David this year, we've been wanting this for years and praying about it, and we finally got someone that knows what they're doing. David's teaching an auto shop class in our school this year. We used to have one years and years ago. And Mrs. Cook is teaching a home ec class. And the kids love it. They think it's the neatest thing. They're going to learn to do something. You've got to change the oil. Now, you may not be the greatest mechanic. That's not what we're asking for. But at least you know enough to where the mechanic ain't going to rip you off. You know they do that. I love it. One time I went down to, I won't tell you what the place, but had my oil changed, and I started changing it myself. Called me. All your ball bearings and rotors and cat, they're just terrible. I said, oh, really? Well, I replaced them about 3 weeks ago. Never went back there. I don't like that. That's dishonesty. So at least a kid could know something about their car. I think it's a good thing. Learn those things. I'm getting way off track. But this is where we were here in the 1800s, is modern influence. Pestalozzi, and he's the one that influenced William McClure, who wrote all those journals that Horace Mann was reading. So here's a guy, what do you think of a guy, that doesn't know anything about education, and he's going to read liberal journals, and then he's going to model for the rest of the country how it's supposed to be done. Not a very good system. But let's continue on here real quick. I wanted to talk about, I had these big visions of grandeur that I'm going to cover all these people, and I'm still on the first slideshow that I made a month ago. We're going to get there. Prussia was a country area. What happened was Napoleon came in and defeated them, so Prussia's like, man, what happened? We were defeated. How did this happen that we were all defeated with Napoleon? And they blamed it on the fact that the people emphasized themselves too much instead of the state. The people didn't stand up and want to help the state. They just kind of, okay, Napoleon, we can't stop you. And we're not going to get into all the history of all that kind of thing, but they decided we've got to change this. And so you know what they did? They said education must train loyalty to the state. Loyalty to the state. So, you know, all this military struggle and all these things. And so these fathers of the country determined that education has to be changed, revamped, so that they can be loyal to the state. And here's what they said. Subordinate themselves with no questions asked. Now, hold on a minute. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole debate because, like I said, you have to choose what you want to do. But it was funny. I was reading a story, a lady that was in, I don't remember what state it was, the Walmart there had a massive sign, and it said, by federal mandate, and again, don't misunderstand me, you do what you need to do, and I'm not making fun of anything, I'm just using an example. By federal mandate, you must wear a mask. And she went up to him and said, that's a lie. There is no federal mandate. And they didn't know what to say. And again, you do what you need to do. I tell the kids at school, you wear it. I'm saying, you do what you need to do. It's no problem. No problem. Everybody make their own decision. It's fine. But to say, we were talking yesterday about Todd and I, about weasel words. Mandate? That's a little different than recommend. little bit different than recommend. But see, they want people, just like here in Prussia, you just submit to the state, no questions asked. You know, you see the old black and white, you know, the factory, and just, you know, that's literally what they wanted. This is the start of socialism and communism. These are the people that the public education fathers are imbibing and reading and thinking they're the greatest thing in the world. And so this began to come over to America. Here's the things quickly that they wanted. They wanted obedient workers, obedient soldiers, subordinated government servants, subordinated industry workers, and like-minded citizens. And the way they're going to do it is through education. We're going to look at that next week. And I hope that you see, again, I'm not trying to attack anything. I personally believe that the system of public education is wrong. The system is anti-biblical. I'm just going to lay it out there. And I've said it before, there are good people. I know good Christian people that are in the public schools that teach or that are administrators. I know some good ones. No problem. They do what they believe the Lord wants them to do. But I'm talking about the system and the philosophy of it has a specific agenda. And they're trying to get it through. And you're going to see in the next, we've already seen it. The last 10 years have been insane, the changes in our country. You're going to see in another 5 or 10 years even more changes because of what the kids are growing up to come in positions of leadership and authority that have been really indoctrinated into things that are anti-biblical. Father, just help us in this time to understand your word and to follow those things that are right, to not be influenced by things that Lord, Satan would love to divide and take over with us. And Father, help us in this study as we continue the next few weeks that we'd be able to understand. It's in Christ's name, amen. I appreciate your good attention. Thank you.